Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Computer Vision in Production podcast show. A podcast show where we talk all about everything computer vision, from the individual components of the technology, including vision, cameras, and deep learning, right through to hearing about some of the most interesting applications that companies are using at the moment. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Computer Vision in Production podcast. I'm your host, Anthony Kelly. Today's guest is Kynan Eng, who is the CEO and co-founder at Swiss-based startup Innovation. Kynan, welcome to the podcast. It's great to have you on the show.
Yeah, thanks very much, Anthony, for the invitation. Pleased to be here.
Yeah, no, really, really good to have someone from such an exciting company such as yourself, almost an OG of computer vision, I guess you could say.
Hope so, one day. Yeah.
So, Kynan, I suppose, look, for those people who haven't maybe heard of yourself before or heard of Innovation, why don't you start off by giving us a little bit of a personal background of yourself? What got you into AI and computer vision? And then we'll kind of take it into Innovation from there.
So, as you might hear from my accent, I was born and raised in Australia, but I've lived in Switzerland for over 20 years. And originally, my background was in computer science and mechanical engineering. And then later during my PhD, I got into neuroscience and virtual reality. And one of the things I always wanted to do was to build intelligent systems that could interact with the real world, you know, which naturally led to computer vision, robotics. And yeah, through a long series of coincidences, I now find myself running Innovation, which is producing ultra high speed vision systems for many different applications.
Excellent. Thanks, Kynan. So I suppose, look, we're talking about Innovation here more specifically. Appreciate, you know, you've given us a bit of an idea of your background, but, you know, where did the concept from Innovation come from? You know, 6 years ago, what happened to make you, or maybe a group, the group of you, turn around and say, yeah, do you know what? This is what I'm thinking the future is going to be, because you know, you were talking about vision systems, really understanding the eye before, when everyone else was thinking about vision systems, right? You went a different way. You could have went into something, you know, maybe more perception related, but you've gone for a completely different style of product. What was that experience like, or what was the thought process that you and the founders went through?
Yeah, so actually the thought process predates my involvement. So this work in neuromorphic vision actually goes back to research done at Caltech in the early 90s in the lab of Carver Mead. So he was one of the pioneers of the field, and his PhD student, Misha Mohorwald. And what happened in the mid-90s was that the ETH Zurich poached a bunch of these guys at Caltech, you know, the real founders of the field. And they started an institute looking into neuromorphic engineering at the end of 95. I joined this institute in 2000. That's when I started my PhD. And so I've been involved in sort of thinking about this for 20 years now. And it's been a sort of a long process of slowly migrating the stuff we were doing from the lab, firstly to prototypes that other people could use. And then in the past 5-6 years actually making the run towards industry and really narrowing down the applications where we see that this technology works best.
Yeah, okay, cool. And you guys kind of, the main product that you guys have there is called Dynamic Vision Platform, right?
That's right. So this is a combination of a custom sensor and software. And so what's special about the sensor is that it's not like a normal vision sensor. A normal vision sensor, you take a picture, then you send all the data over somewhere else and you process that data. And this act of capturing all the data and then sending it all across to somewhere else for processing dates back to the very beginnings of computer vision and actually to the very beginnings of photography. And the problem with this method is that it's very slow and very efficient. You're using a lot of energy and time to capture everything only to send it away somewhere else for processing. A much more efficient way of doing this, which is actually what your retina and your visual cortex does, is as soon as the light comes into your eye, it's already starting to process this information while it's still in your retina. So your retina, you know, doesn't output pictures. There are actually layers of cells in your retina which already start to do pre-processing of the signal before it even gets sent to the brain. And it's this type of very early stage processing that we're starting to replicate in our custom silicon chip combined with the software stack that we have developed.
Nice. Pretty cool. I was quite interested in the understanding of the layers before the retina that we actually have for pre-processing. I've always been, since the concept of, you know, spending more time in computer vision, I've always been more interested in actually understanding the eye and how and why we see the way we do, right?
Yes. I mean, actually, we still don't understand everything that's happening in the retina, right? We have some idea. For example, there are some cells that seem to be sensitive to motion, right? So motion up or down, left or right. There are other cells that seem to be sensitive to edges. So that means they must be looking at adjacent cells in the retina or pixels if we want to translate to technology. So we have cells or pixels that are acting as edge detectors. Then there are cells in the retina which seem to cover quite large areas. So they might be encoding shapes or forms that are moving around in different ways. And they're actually cells which seem to respond to movement across very large areas of your retina, a large part of your visual field. And we still don't know what this encoding is useful for. We have some ideas that it's probably related to shapes and the overall understanding of the scene. But we still don't know what technology can take advantage of this yet. And so what we have done actually in our sensor is reduce this down to the simplest possible thing, which is basically just every pixel responding only if the brightness of that pixel changes. And we have a custom analog circuit in every pixel, which is doing this constant comparison of the incoming light with reference voltages in the sensor itself. So if the light increases above a certain level, it sends a signal. And if it decreases below another level, it sends another signal. And so this is sort of like our minimum viable retina, you could call it.
Okay, nice. And so I suppose, look, my next question is, you know, where does this DVS product fit in? Who's going to use it? What's your potential customers? What are they going to be doing?
Yeah, where this, let's call it minimum viable retina, is useful is in dealing with situations where you are very constrained in terms of speed and power at the same time. With custom systems, sometimes you need to respond much faster than you could expose a normal photo and then go and send it somewhere and get it processed. One example, which is what we're working on right now, is in ultra high speed eye tracking. This we've targeted as a key application because your eyes move very fast. And in the upcoming markets for augmented and virtual reality, the faster you can track your eye, the better the user experience, both in terms of the quality of the graphics and also in terms of the battery life that you can get out of your system. And we're able to basically run our eye tracking systems about 10 times faster than anybody else at either the same or lower power consumption. And so this has generated a lot of interest with our customers, with our large headset producers. So that's just one example of the type of applications.
Nice. And then I suppose, look, one thing that I've seen, you know, pretty prevalent on the innovation website is, you know, how users are bringing neuromorphic machine vision to life. So we use kind of looking at helping out machines with better understanding. I suppose, look, in many cases, it could be the end of a production line of a quality system, or could be robotic DIs for a robotic arm. Is that kind of something else you would look at, or do you see much of a future in that?
Yeah, that's correct, right? We're good in any situation where you need to be extremely fast and you're operating either under a time and a power constraint. And so other examples of the types of things we've done projects on, for example, one in robotic production, it's actually with Daimler, where they need to be able to guide their robots in gluing or welding operations. And the robot needs to respond very fast to any changes. For example, the glue is not quite in the right spot. And that's where we've been able to show that our technology has unique speed advantages. Another application where we are in a very power-constrained system, but need to be fast and low data, is actually in space. in satellite positioning, for example. And we just heard a few weeks ago that one of our sensors was on a satellite which was launched from New Zealand just 2 weeks ago. So that's the first neuromorphic technology in space, which of course we're pretty excited about. And we're really looking forward to exploring more deeply these opportunities in satellite applications.
That's pretty cool. Do you see, maybe you guys can be the eyes on the Mars rover?
One day, yes, definitely. I mean, I think where we, that's a good example, right, to clarify. So at the moment, the Mars rovers run very slowly, right, because you can't run a real-time control loop with a human in the loop. And so the cameras on there, they take nice pictures, right? You sit around for a long time, you take a nice picture, and then you send that back. And the reason that the Mars rovers move so slowly is because everything needs to be scanned and planned way in advance, right? They can't just have the robot run off and react on its own, right? Because there's a very strict power budget limit on the rover, right? It either has a small nuclear power source or is running on solar power. And so basically it just doesn't have enough power to run ultra low power vision systems. And we think that's something, that kind of space exploration is where we can offer a real advantage, providing fast vision at very low power budgets.
Yeah. It kind of links very well up with my next question. You know, you've got all these, you know, really cool sort of potential applications that you can put on, you know, talking about hypothetically Mars rovers, robotic arms, QA systems. But, you know, how easy is it to bring your DVS product and deploy it on hardware? You know, what's that process look like? Is it easy? Is it tough?
Yeah. So, you know, by definition, I'm in a startup, so it's tough, right? There's no... There are no easy goals, unfortunately. But, you know, we've been making good progress bit by bit, right? And this is, it's sort of a tightrope in what you do, right? You don't want to oversell it at the beginning, but you do want to give people a taste, a tantalizing taste of the potential, right? So, for example, getting it up into space is definitely, you know, one big step for us, so to speak. And so the key for us has been to build partnerships from the very beginning, actually even before we started the company. We were selling prototypes before the company was even created. For mass production, we have a partnership with Samsung. They're one of our investors. So that, you know, if someone says, look, you know, we need to buy 100 million, we can say, that's fine. You know, Samsung can produce that for you. If you need a custom one for space, you know, we can do that. We can do exactly what you want. And so I think this combination of having the right partnerships and always trying to back up our promises with real results is one of the keys to being able to succeed in this kind of venture where it will take a long time for this new technology to filter through into each of the different application niches.
Yeah. That's really, really interesting. And coming on to that, I suppose actually not coming on to it, but moving away from it and more so into something we touched on a little bit earlier, but something that really up your street also is eye tracking. I suppose, look, the first one is we've talked a little bit about eye tracking, but I suppose when it comes to building computer vision products, why bother with eye tracking? Like, you know, not many companies are doing it anyway. So why have you decided to focus around this particular area?
Eye tracking is a bit like VR overall in that they're, you know, VR, it's not the first time VR has been coming, right? It's been coming for the last 20 years. Technologies have come and gone. Eye tracking startups have come and gone before. What's different this time is that for the first time, all the technology components are in place. In particular, small high-resolution screens, right? Which of course comes from the mobile phone industry, and small high-performance processors, which again comes from the mobile phone industry. So it's really the mobile phone industry that has enabled the VR industry to really get started this time. There are several eye tracking companies out there right now. They range in size, you know, from us or smaller than us to actually there's even one or two eye tracking companies that have already IPO'd in a research market. Eye tracking is actually something that's been of quite large interest for medical applications and also for market research applications. For example, you know, companies want to know if they lay out their web page in a particular way, they want to know where people are looking. And so they want to collect data on that. And so that's been a significant niche for a long time. And what's happening now is that eye tracking technology is now making the migration onto VR headsets as the first mass market application of the technology. That's the one we're going for. We're going straight to the mass market application.
And can I ask, so personally myself, I don't know if it's been driven by COVID, but do you think like the VR industry has received a boost because of COVID, or were you targeting this domain before COVID? Because, you know, I'm looking at a lot of companies now looking, or I know we don't have the technology there, but you see the question asked a lot. What about a virtual conference? You know, and was this the company's plan before COVID, or even have you seen an increase maybe in demand of your product in VR with COVID?
So we were already working on it before COVID. We hadn't made any announcements, but COVID has definitely increased the relevance of all remote interaction technologies, right? Just things like Zoom and Teams, and VR is, you know, just the next step in that, right? You know, Zoom and Teams work reasonably well, but people want to have the feeling that they are in a meeting, right? And that's why people are much more receptive to the idea of putting on a VR headset for a meeting now than they would have been before COVID, you know, just because it's as close as they can get to physically traveling, which is physically impossible at the moment.
Yeah. I was going to say, yeah, do you think that's the next domain? It's these actual virtual meetings. Everyone in the team throws on a headset. You sit around the round table, have your VR meeting in real time.
Yes, I think this will become the thing, right? The headsets are finally good enough that you don't feel motion sickness as soon as you put them on. I think it's not going to displace anything except maybe travel. People will still make phone calls like they've always done. People will still use Zoom and Teams. But for certain types of meeting where there's a real benefit from having a sense of 3D presence, then people will switch to their headsets. And so the big question, you know, the big use case question is, what are those scenarios where the headset really provides a benefit?
Yeah.
And I think my sort of first guess is, it's the type of meetings or interactions where the emotions or the social aspect is the critical thing, right? So for example, if I'm having an engineering meeting, it actually probably doesn't matter that much. But if you're having, you know, say a diplomacy kind of call, or, you know, first time you're talking to a customer, the extra cues that come from 3D, you know, might be the thing that tips it for you and therefore worth investing in.
Yeah, I would also say, now it's my background, but, you know, helping people with virtual onboarding, you know, it's Teams is great, Zoom is great, but, you know, you kind of want that idea of having that physical presence with someone, making them feel welcome. You just can't kind of do with just the square upper shoulders and face, right?
Yes, yeah, exactly. I think, yeah, we agree with each other, right? It's the feeling, right? It's the feeling of being welcome, of being, you know, physically, you know, being real, so to speak, right? Being treated as though you're real. Definitely what VR really helps with.
Yeah. And I suppose, look, within that, so look, my experience with VR goggles were, you know, you're probably talking 5, 6, 7 years ago, where it was all head tilted motions. So where does iris tracking come in on this? Is it going to create a complete vision the way we see our vision now in VR, as opposed to, you know, I know I was looking at the application as it was new. I couldn't see anything unless I physically spun my head around the room, right?
Yeah. So I think the difference that our eye tracking will make is actually there's like an obvious part, and then there's a not obvious part that should be invisible. So the obvious part is, you know, using the gaze vector as an interaction modality in itself.
Yeah. Right?
For example, you know, blink to click and this kind of thing, or, you know, hover over an area by staring at it. That kind of interaction modality is actually a bit tricky to feel natural. And I think people are still looking for the right eye movement vocabulary for that kind of interaction. But where I actually see the, let's say, the no-brainer case is in what's called foveated rendering. And in the idea of foveated rendering is that there's no point rendering your VR scene in maximum detail if you're not actually looking at that part of the scene. And so foveated rendering basically provides maximum detail in your scene where your eye is looking, and then in the rest of the scene it provides less detail. And so this means you can save compute on your GPU and therefore save power and therefore improve battery life. This is the thing, you know, that's invisible to the user, but a huge benefit, because, you know, you can double your battery life or you can have a smaller battery depending on your priorities. And this is the thing that all the headset makers are looking for, right? They see it as a necessary part of the system because they need to get as close as they can to all day usage on a headset if it's really going to be used for work.
Nice. That's really cool. Where did that sort of concept come from?
It's been around for a while, actually. I mean, even from the very first days of computer graphics, right, where compute was even more constrained, right? You would naturally try to do as little rendering as possible. And so people started off by doing less rendering on objects that are further away. Then they would start, you know, just do less rendering on the edges because you're more likely to be looking at stuff in the center. And when eye tracking came along, the idea came along that, okay, if we can track the eye fast enough, then in theory, you would only have to render maximum detail where the fovea is looking. And so the shorter the delay on the rendering, the less you need to render, and therefore the more battery life you saved. And that's where our USP comes in, right? We're the fastest, and therefore we can keep up with where the eye is moving the best, and therefore you need to render the smallest possible area and get the best battery life.
Yeah. Okay, nice. And so I suppose, look, on that rendering topic, does that affect, let's say, if we're in a VR environment having a conversation with each other, where does like the edge rendering of my virtual animation or your virtual animation or the human rendering aspect come into it? Or is that something not so much built by you? Or maybe if you throw on maybe an Oculus, is that something that's built into them? Or where does that sort of connection come in to make it really immersive? You know, you kind of want to have the smoothest interaction as possible.
Yeah. So with the foveated rendering, the goal is to decrease the rendering just before the point where the user notices it, right? And this is a subjective thing because, you know, different people will notice reductions in quality in their peripheral vision more than others.
Yeah.
And so there have been a couple of studies done about, you know, how much you can reduce the quality in foveated rendering in the periphery compared with the fovea area. The very rough result is that with foveated rendering, you can typically save about 50% of your GPU, up to 50% of your GPU, right? Which then translates into, you know, up to 50% extra battery, or up to double the battery life.
That's a pretty, pretty big improvement. So look, I suppose outside of, you know, maybe VR meetings where you can add in that human interaction, you know, where else do you see computer vision and AR going in the future, you know, over the next maybe 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 years?
AR, VR in general?
Well, I suppose if we talk about AR, VR and, you know, maybe added in deep learning, how it's as a combined topic, the two of them together.
To answer that question in a broad sense, if we actually move away from innovations technology for a minute, in a previous life, I was actually doing neuroscience experiments on VR. And back then I was actually looking at whether different VR modalities would affect brain processing and how. To give you an example of a very simple experiment I did, it was published in 2008. What we did was we had some virtual arms on the screen, right, in a first-person view, right, so sort of like a first-person shooter kind of scenario, but very unrealistic. And we had these arms doing some simple movements, and we had two groups of subjects. The first group of subjects just looked at the screen with the virtual arms, and they just had to pay attention, and that was it, right? And we controlled for their attention. The second group were looking at these virtual arms, and then we also told them, okay, imagine that these virtual arms are your arms, as if you're in a VR environment and those virtual arms are yours. And so basically both groups watched this for about a minute. And then as a surprise, we had a non-realistic virtual knife come in and stab one of the arms. And then there was not very realistic blood coming out. Right. And of course, you know, they were surprised. Both groups were surprised. And we were measuring their stress response, the galvanic skin response, basically how much they're sweating. Right. And actually, the group that was imagining that their arms were theirs, they had a higher response, right? So they were more stressed by this virtual knife than the people who were paying attention but were not actively imagining. And so this told us, you know, this interesting idea that the act of you believing that you're part of this virtual space is actually important for your physiological response. Right, so there's definitely a link between your brain processing and what you're seeing and what you were told to imagine. And to cut a long story short, we were looking at applications of this in neurorehabilitation for stroke patients, you know, kids with cerebral palsy, and so on. And you know, we did a whole bunch of clinical studies, you know, neuroimaging experiments, trying to narrow down what parts of the brain are involved in observing an action compared with imitating, trying to imitate an action compared with imagining performing an action. You know, there's a whole body of research in this area, which is quite interesting. And I mean, we did this research over 10 years ago, and just now it's starting to come into more common clinical use. There are a number of startups looking at, you know, using VR for dealing with pain, for example, pain which can be caused by spinal cord injury or, you know, phantom limb if you've lost a limb and so on. And all of these disorders seem to be related to problems with your body image, right? How your real body image somehow is not coherent with the body image that was stored in your brain because something happened to change it and then causes pain. And so this use of VR as an analgesic, as a replacement for drugs or a complement for painkillers, is something that's building up, and I think that's going to become quite a standard as we go on. That's just one example of where I see the field going.
That's amazing. That really cool. Kind of like some Black Mirror stuff, yeah. To be fair.
Yes, yeah, a little bit of that, right?
I can't think of the episode, but it's the one where it's the elderly people, they put on the VR goggles and they go and live in another life while they're, I suppose, pretty much dying, right? It gives them that idea that they feel good and still enjoy their time, right?
Yeah, that's, you know, extrapolated, you know, combine that with Neuralink, Elon Musk's thing. You know, the Black Mirror episode had VR plus brain implants plus the idea that if you could simulate the brain well enough, then you can basically discard the organic brain and then live on as an algorithm, right? Which, you know, brings up all sorts of ethical and philosophical questions.
Hey, do you know what? If I got to live on repeat, scoring the winner of the Champions League final for Liverpool, I think I'd be okay with that. You know, that's my personal ethics, but you can take me. Yeah. But yeah, you know, that kind of, look, we're obviously a bit away from that. That's if ever even going to achieve it. But I mean, look, in terms of having VR environments for training, maybe doctors, maybe even training young football players at home, you know, is that something that we're probably a bit closer to, do you think, or are we still a million miles away?
VR for training doctors, that's already a thing. There are a couple of
companies. Is it applied though? I've heard of it being used, but I've not seen one of the applications, right? But I've heard of it, but I wasn't sure if it was something that was actually productionized.
Yes, it's production. So how it started was sort of in a restricted sense, in that they would train specific surgical procedures. And the ones they started with are arthroscopy. And the reason for that is, you know, with arthroscopy, you're basically sticking a camera into someone's knee, for example. And then cutting away a bit of cartilage or something. And so the doctor's operating virtually anyway, right? You know, they're looking at a camera. And if you're looking through a camera, why not simulate that in computer graphics? Have them using similar instruments, the same instruments, poke the instruments into a rubber knee, you know, and then measure the movements of the instruments and map that onto your simulation of their knee. And then you have a sort of a, let's call it first generation virtual reality training device for arthroscopy.
Yeah.
And so there are a couple of quite successful companies that started on that over 10 years ago. And, you know, then from there, then people are moving on to, you know, trying to combine, you know, you could call it like a mixed reality surgery.
I was actually just going to ask that exact question. I goes, is it easier to create a super accurate VR environment, or is it easier to kind of go for that mixed reality? You know, let's say I'll give an easier one, maybe not so much surgery. That's a bit threatening, right? But if I wanted to be a live attendance of a concert and I wanted to put on the goggles, is it recorded or will we ever be there live, right?
Yeah. There are companies, yeah, trying to sell, you know, virtual concert experiences. They, you know, they haven't hit the mainstream yet, partly because of the headsets are not yet mainstream. You know, it requires a very large market for this to work.
Yeah.
What has found a market is specific business applications. The one I know of the best is for treating PTSD. And it actually started with the US military. You know, they were dealing with soldiers who'd come back from Iraq, and they needed to help the soldiers to recreate the situation they were in, right? And normally that's done by talking through the situation. So what they did was they basically created PTSD-inducing scenarios so that the patients could walk through the scenario in a realistic way, because they feel like they're in the tank or whatever the situation is, but in a safe way that can, you know, they can pause the action, talk about it. That's actually, yeah, become quite a thing for military rehabilitation, at least in the United States, of course.
That's amazing. Not to go, you know, Joe Rogan on it, but he often talks about, you know, using like hallucinogenics to try and get over PTSD.
Yeah, I mean, virtual reality is a kind of hallucinogen, right?
Yeah.
A non-pharmacological hallucinogen.
Yeah, no, definitely. But look, Kynan, thank you for your time. I think we're just hitting the end here. So I really do appreciate it. If anyone wants to reach out to you to maybe ask you some questions about innovation or anything, what's the best way for them to contact you?
The easiest way is just find me on LinkedIn or send a message to us at Innovation. Just go to the homepage, innovation.com, and they will find the contact details there. Yeah, happy to talk with anyone who's interested.
Yeah, amazing. Really fantastic concepts. Love the topic. But yeah, for everyone listening, this was the Computer Vision in Production podcast. I'm your host, Anthony Kelly. Today's guest was Kynan Eng, who's the CEO and co-founder at Innovation. Kynan, thanks a million for being on the show. Great to have you.
You're welcome. Thanks a lot, Anthony.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Computer Vision in Production podcast with your host, Anthony Kelly. To make sure you get updates on the latest episodes of the show, make sure you subscribe on your preferred podcast listening app or add me on LinkedIn.